Welcome, Book Report listeners. It's good to have you back for our weekly journey together in the amazing world of books. Okay, calendar countdown. Gulp. There are only a few shopping days until Christmas, so I'm here to help with some fun ideas. And this week, because a little levity goes a long way at this frenetic time of year, we're going to focus on comedy titles just out as audiobooks. Yes, forget warming the cockles of your heart. We're going straight for the good cheer to try to get a chuckle out of you. We'll also be talking to author John Waters. Yes, his book is eminently giftable. Allow me to surprise you. Finally, because Americans have had a long, loving relationship with late-night TV, I've picked two audio titles to preview that put the spotlight on two very different kind of guys, both of whom you've probably invited into your bedroom at some point, Dick Cavett and Craig Ferguson. Each is really funny in their own unique way. So sit back, settle in, and let's dash through the show, laughing all the way.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
All By Myself is comedy superstar Jeff Dunham's story, told by Jeff himself. This unique comedic audio release takes fans behind the curtain to explain how Jeff turned a tired, vaudevillian art form, ventriloquism, into something truly modern, hip, and hysterical. Not only does Jeff reveal how he developed his act and lovable characters, he also shares details of his life as a working comedian and the challenges of being a family man on the road. Best of all, Jeff's hilarious suitcase posse, Walter, Peanut, and Ahmed, personally add their humorous perspectives. Get ready for some serious ho-ho-hoing as Jeff Dunham narrates All By Myself.
Sometimes when I hear a great comedian, I think, wow, he's funny. Wonder what screwed him up. This, of course, isn't every comic, but a lot of them, admittedly, could have had happier childhoods. I don't envy the guys who grew up with a great deal of strife, but many of them have been able to mine their early years for comedy gold. Fortunately or unfortunately, that's not me. I've had to work really hard at being funny because pretty much everything for me as a kid was positive, uneventful, and almost boring. Sure, Lady Godiva and William the Conqueror are somewhere in the Dunham lineage, but I was adopted. That means wacky ancestors don't count, right? My parents, Howard and Joyce Dunham, adopted me a few months after my birth in April of 1962. I had a happy, drama-free youth growing up in an upper-middle-class neighborhood in Dallas, Texas. The only thing that was slightly unusual compared to most of my friends was that I was an only child. I don't think that's why my parents gave me a dummy. At least they've never copped to it.
If your parents only knew then what they know now.
What's that supposed to mean?
Wonder if it's still too late to return you and get a refund.
My father was the sole proprietor of the oldest real estate appraisal firm in Dallas until he retired a few years ago. My mother is a housewife. They are solid, church-going Christian folk, and my mother still gets upset when one of my characters uses bad language. I keep trying to tell her, Mom, it's not me. Not long ago, when I told my parents that I would be writing this book, my mother turned to my father and, as if I wasn't even sitting there, said, I'm very worried about what he might say about us. To which my father replied, I'm very worried he won't say anything about us.
Your dad's like a comedian.
Did he beat you as a child?
No.
That's too bad.
My mother and father have always supported me. Now in their 80s, they actually clamber onto the tour bus with me once or twice a year so they can watch the performances and hear the crowds. Traveling with 80-something-year-olds on a tour bus? There has to be some sort of reality show in that. But even if my parents are cool with life on the road, no one will ever describe them as hip. However, if it hadn't been for them, I may never have become a comedian. As I mentioned earlier, the seeds were sown very early in elementary school. At 8, I was a fairly typical kid. I did well in school and had a few friends in our neighborhood. I rode my bike everywhere and would take off on all kinds of adventures, usually alone, to explore as far as I could pedal before dark. Rain or shine, freezing rain or searing heat, I would ride my bike to school every day. In sickness, I got the perfect attendance award every year from first through sixth grade. I wasn't an athlete, but my parents insisted I play on every baseball, soccer, and basketball team possible. Of course, the only sport I really liked was football, but they wouldn't let me play that because the mother of the only child thought I'd get killed. The same group of elementary school boys from my grade was on every team, and I was always the third worst player. If teams were being chosen at recess, I was one of the last three guys picked. I was just beginning to see girls in a new light, and Cub Scouts was starting to lose its minimal appeal. I wasn't exactly looking for something new to do, but I certainly hadn't found anything I was particularly good at yet. Just before Christmas in 1970, my mother and I were walking around in a store called Toy Fair at the Northwood Hills Shopping Center. For my birthday that year, I had picked out a purple Murray bicycle, a banana seat two-wheeler from the same store. I didn't have an older brother or a knowledgeable enough dad to tell me I should have pushed for the much cooler Schwinn Stingray. As we walked around the store, I begged my mom for stuff here and there. I kept saying, "It's not too close to Christmas, please!" Of course, I now realize she had taken me there to get ideas for Santa and had no intention of buying anything that day. After we rounded a corner, just above my head, I saw a small, vinyl, orange-haired, buck-toothed ventriloquist dummy. His name was Mortimer Snurd. I'd seen ventriloquists perform on television, but had never seen a dummy in real life. He was a simple little guy, about 2.5 feet tall with a cloth body, a fake straw hat, a little checkered suit, and a bow tie. Sticking out of the back of his neck was a string you could pull to make his mouth open and close. I took Mortimer down and showed him to my mother. She seemed totally unimpressed. So back he went to his shelf as I went to hunt for other treasures. By the time we got home, I'd forgotten all about him.
From the outrageous and oddly innocent comedian Sarah Silverman comes a memoir, her first book, that is at once personal, surprisingly poignant, and yes, pee in your pants funny. If you like Sarah's television show, The Sarah Silverman Program, or memoirs such as Chelsea Handler's Are You There, Vodka? It's Me, Chelsea, you're going to enjoy The Bedwetter, Stories of Courage, Redemption, and Pee, read by Sarah herself. Okay, it's a whole lot less snarky than you might have thought, and it's high in clarity, warmth, and intelligence. Let's get right into it.
When I first selected myself to write the foreword for my book, I was flattered and deeply moved. It's not every day that someone is asked to write the foreword for such a highly anticipated book by a major publisher. There was a time in my life that I would not have trusted myself with a responsibility like this. The foreword sets the tone for the entire book, and I might well have said, "Sarah, you're not smart enough to handle this." I would have taken the safer route and asked someone other than myself to write it. To trust myself this much, to think so highly of my own literary skills, is a testament to just how far I've come, both personally and professionally. Personally, because I'm finally in a place where I can really look up to myself. And professionally, because I'm now able to see what a coup getting me to write my foreword really is. Not everyone agrees that I should be writing this thing. Take, for example, the people at HarperCollins. They're staunchly opposed to it. old media traditionalists that they are, they seem to be stuck on the idea that a foreword should be written by someone other than the author. They even went so far as to claim that the very point of a foreword is to have someone else writing about the author. Here is an excerpt of an email chain between my editor, David Hershey, and myself regarding the issue. "Hi, Sarah. Can we talk about the foreword? I really don't think it makes sense for you to write it yourself. Stay Jewish, David. You are dumb and smell fartish. Best wishes, Sarah." "Dear Sarah, I'm sorry that our last discussion regarding the foreword issue is upsetting you. If you perceived a lack of sympathy or any recalcitrance on our part, it is because your suggestion took us a bit by surprise. No one in our history, and we researched this, has ever proposed that they write the foreword on their own memoir. It's a complete contradiction in logic. Best, David." In other words, I guess he's saying that if it was me writing, it would not really be a true foreword. It would simply be the start of the book, thus making the book effectively forwardless. I would argue that if this book is forwardless, how can you be listening to it at this very moment? That said, if you aren't listening to it, I really can't blame you since I've said literally nothing so far. Now then, I have known Sarah, me, for 39 years. I have watched her grow from a flat-chested, gawky little blastocyst into a full-grown woman with big naturals and a major career. Her contributions have ranged from telling offensive racial jokes in dingy comedy clubs to playing a decisive role in getting the first person of color elected president. She has peed on mattresses up and down the Northeast Corridor, and has used the topic of human excrement to vault her from obscurity into the global fame she enjoys today. Her life has been an inspiration, and I look forward to seeing what she does next. With her tremendous reserves of talent, Sarah just might cure AIDS, or at least cause it in deserving people like those genocidal dinks in Darfur. She might become the first Jewish president, or win the NASCAR award if something like that exists, or start some kind of movement, or stop some kind of movement that's especially annoying. Like those people who denounce circumcision and insist on ruining penises across the globe. I guess the effort to stop a movement would be called a re-movement. That's a terrible joke. The first thing Sarah should do with her powers is to put a stop to jokes like that. Sarah is the embodiment of possibility and promise. I love her. Wow, now that's a foreword. Egg on your face much, HarperCollins?
The Prince of Puke, the Pope of Trash. John Waters has been called many things, but when you consider his body of work, you'll see he must be called original. Perhaps you know John from his films. Indeed, Waters managed to create a whole genre of movies best described as trash masterpieces. Pink Flamingos, Serial Mom, and Hairspray, which also became a blockbuster hit on Broadway. His early actor ensemble featured Divine and Mink Stole, then Patty Hearst and porn star Tracy Lords. But watch some of his more recent films and you'd see Johnny Depp, Kathleen Turner, and Tracy Ullman. A reverence and appreciation of the American grotesque. As an artist, Waters explores the tension between mainstream and the extreme. Above all, Waters is a born storyteller. In his latest book, Role Models, Waters profiles his favorite personalities. These characters are as diverse as the owner of his favorite Baltimore bar, Johnny Mathis, Tennessee Williams, Leslie Van Houten, who is the long-incarcerated Charles Manson follower, and Clarabelle, the psychotic clown from Howdy Doody. As Tom Carson wrote in the New York Times book review, Waters can't help revealing on every page that he's both sentimental and good-hearted. Readers, I promised you a generous helping of diversity on this show, so it is my very great pleasure to present John Waters. Welcome, John. I am so thrilled to meet you tonight.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here in Miami.
So I'm wondering, I am so thrilled to meet you, and I'm thinking about and wondering who in the literary world or the arts world you'd like to meet next.
Like to meet next, Gita Sereny, who is an English writer that writes about killers and Nazis and psychological crime, but really well, really smart, really intelligently. She's probably the only person that I'm thinking of that I'm really dying to meet. And maybe I'm her biggest groupie, and so maybe that scared her off. But she's wrote really, really, really good books, certainly about Mary Bell, who was a famous case in London. She also wrote about the Nazis, but in a really, really psychological, really revealing way. And she's a really serious, very, very good writer. Let me think, what other writers would I like to meet? You know, I don't know. In Baltimore, I know Ann Tyler, and I know who I'm a fan of. And certainly, I've met a lot of the writers that I want to meet because I've been doing this for so long, and I go to these book events. I went to the Toronto Book Fair recently, and I sat next to the woman who wrote The Room. And I loved the book, and I had read it, and I didn't even realize it was her till halfway through the interview.
Actually, I just finished reading that book, listening to it on an audiobook, and I thought it was one of the most unique books I have read in such a long time. Emma Donoghue, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can bet they're going to make a movie of it. Well, I'm sure they've sold the movie rights.
Yeah.
Right.
You've had some unusual collaborations with personalities as diverse as Patty Hearst and Tab Hunter. Is there anyone on your radar that you would like to work with next?
Well, that's in the movie business. That's the one great thing about writing a book. You just need to sit down and do it yourself. You don't have to get... you have to do research, but you can't really blame it on anyone else because you had to write the book. I certainly don't use a ghostwriter. But if in the movie business, sure, there's Meryl Streep I'd always love to work with. But I've worked with so many people that I wanted to work with that I've been lucky. Most of them have said yes. And I pick people that I think that have a sense of humor, that will be able to survive Baltimore for 7 weeks on a low budget with the kind of humor we're doing. But I'm very serious when I make the movie, and it's very organized because it's such a low budget that I have to... very little improvisation, or we shoot exactly the shots that I've thought up and exactly the script.
So are you working on a movie now?
No, I'm working on a sort of a secret project that I don't talk about, but I never talk about something before I do it because it's like people, not that I know, but people say, do you tell somebody if you're trying to get pregnant? No. And so
some of my friends did.
Well, yeah, but you know, I don't. I think it's bad luck. But I am working on that, and my book Role Models comes out in UK for Christmas. So I go on the British book tour next Thursday after Thanksgiving, and I have a spoken word act, a Christmas show that I do all over the country. So I'm going on tour for that, and I have another spoken word act called This Filthy World that I do year round that I do all the time too.
Mm-hmm. For our listeners who have not yet read your book, explain the criteria you used to select your role models.
Well, my role models were people that led a life more extreme than I did and were braver than I ever had to be. Therefore, they gave me the courage to survive both success and failure because I wrote about people that have had incredible mainstream success, which is also very hard to survive sometimes, as we see by reading biographies of all stars, or people that have done something very terrible, like one of the so-called Manson women, Leslie Van Houten, who met a madman when she was 17 and has been in jail for 40 years, and I argue for her release. Because what do you do when you look back on something so terrible that you did when you're young? And you've, however, I think, paid a large price that she should have paid. Going to jail for 40 years is not nothing. And she has participated in a system that told her if she followed everything that she would eventually be able to make parole. She did not get life without parole. So I argue for it, but I think fairly. I bring up all the worst things the most devastating things the victim's family said against her relief, which I think I have to. And a defense lawyer does never do that.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you cite Tennessee Williams as a role model. Who are the other authors and playwrights whom you admire?
Well, in the book, the other authors basically are Denton Welsh, the English writer, Ivy Compton Burnett, who wrote extremely difficult English novels that were all dialogue. I wrote Lionel Shriver, who is one of my favorite writers, who wrote We Need to Talk About Kevin, but she's written a lot of other really, really good novels, too, and one of her books is this year nominated for the British Book Award. Who else? I'm trying to think that I write about in the book. Christina Stead. I pick hard writers. I like ones that are difficult. I don't understand when people say I like a feel-good book. I feel good before I read a book. I don't expect a book to make me feel good. I don't want an easy book. People say, I just want something to relax with. Well, go take drugs if you want to relax. Or drink or something. I read a book to get smarter and to learn something about people's behavior, which is always interests me.
So what books are currently on your bedside table or in your suitcase?
I'm just finishing the biography of Sal Mineo that just came out.
Wasn't he from Pittsburgh? I'm from Pittsburgh.
No, he wasn't from Pittsburgh. He was from the Bronx.
Oh.
Yeah. Pittsburgh's Andy Warhol, certainly.
I know.
And I was on the board of the Warhol Foundation. So that is what I have with me. And I have one of Lionel Shriver's older novels that I haven't read in my suitcase that I'll read on the plane tomorrow.
And are you working on a new book right now?
I'm not working on a new book yet, no. I'm working on this film and this TV project, but I'm gonna do another book. I have two other books that I wrote, Crackpot and Shock Value, that have never gone out of the print. And the first one came out in 1980. They've been in print for 30 years.
And how do you juggle all the projects that you do during the day or in a week?
I don't juggle them. I'm good at compartmentalize. What's the word?
Compartmentalize.
That's the word.
Yeah.
I have a lot of folders of things in development. If I'm going to work on the book, I just work on the book that day. If I work on my artwork, I go to my studio. If I'm thinking up a movie, I get out different folders. I use the same pads, the same pens. I handwrite everything. So I'm just organized. I write every day. I wrote in my hotel today. I never miss a morning, Monday to Friday.
How many hours a day?
Oh, it depends. Usually 8 to 11 or 12.
Wow. You and Ann Tyler really put Baltimore on the literary and film landscape. Does Baltimore remain your muse?
Yes, it really does. Baltimore inspires me completely. Whenever I need an idea, I go back to Baltimore. And I watch people there. I read the local press. I follow stories. I go out there. I go to bars there. I think if you ever want to know about a city, go to the bars. Hang out in the bars. And in Baltimore, we have churches, bars, and beauty parlors. There's one on each block.
Well, thank you so much, John. Role Models, it's a great read. Readers, you'll want to pick it up. Thank you, John.
Sure, thank you.
And now, let's listen to John himself narrating Role Models.
Little did I imagine that the gathering would turn into a red-hot necking party. While her innocent parents, who were good friends of my mom and dad, were upstairs happily laying out refreshments, all the kids downstairs were grinding and French kissing to Johnny Mathis's music. And I knew then that not only did I want to be a teenager, I wanted to be the exaggeration of a teenager. But I had always felt nuts, not romantic, too angry to be smooth, too happily guilty to yearn for virtue. Before Johnny Mathis, Clarabelle, the psychotic clown on the Howdy Doody show, whose makeup later inspired Divines, had been my role model. The man I saw in person in the early 50s at the height of Howdy Doody's success, when I was just a kid and my parents somehow got me on the show. The scary freak I watched from the peanut gallery, who never spoke but communicated his hostility by honking twin bicycle horns or by squirting you in the face from a seltzer bottle. The same TV character parents complained about for getting their children too excited before dinner. Excited? I was apoplectic. Especially every time Clarabelle got near Princess Summerfall Winterspring, the goody-goody but sexy Indian maiden non-puppet star of the show. If only he could have burst out of his glorious muteness to say her name out loud, the best name ever. The only other name I wish were mine today, except for Lord and Lady Haw Haw, which I can't use because they were Nazis. Matter of fact, readers of this book, if you see me on the street and call me Princess Summerfall Winterspring in a nice tone of voice, I will probably respond. I followed the careers of Clarabelle and Princess Summerfall Winterspring forever, hoping that I too could someday have an extreme career in show business. I mourned the fact that I was unable and uninvited to attend the 1957 funeral of Judy Tyler, the actress who played Summerfall Winterspring, after her tragic death in a car accident right before the release of the Elvis movie she had co-starred in, Jailhouse Rock. All Dutyville was there that day in Hartsdale, New York, and I bet Bob Keeshan was sobbing out loud. Yes, that's the real name of the first Clarabelle the Clown, who went even further in television career lunacy and became Captain Kangaroo for 30 years after.
Imagine his schizophrenia. Am I Clarabelle or Captain Kangaroo? Why are those children staring at me? Who am I? Claraboo? Captain Kangabelle? God, what a life. What a career. Bob Keeshan, I wish I were you too. But would Johnny Mathis understand all this? Luckily, we were both represented by the same talent agency, so I called Steve Rabineau, my film agent, and he called Johnny's people, who suggested I write a letter to Mr. Mathis explaining why I wanted to talk to him. Explain. Explain what? A role model? Someone who has led a life even more explosive than mine? A person whose exaggerated fame or notoriety has made him or her somehow smarter and more glamorous than I could ever be? A person frozen in an unruly, blown-out-of-proportion position in society who earns my unmitigated respect for his or her other turbulent, ferocious will to survive frightening success or failure? Maybe Johnny Mathis could understand, but I'd better leave out the Princess Summerfall, Winter Spring part of my explanation. So I wrote a personal letter telling Mr. Mathis who I was, and I still don't know if he had ever heard of me, and described the tower video parking lot imagery and how this book was an attempt to pay tribute to amazing people who have inspired me. I added that I was not coming to him with any agenda, sexual, racial, ageist, or political, and I really wasn't. My Johnny Mathis lunacy was way beyond that anyway, but I tried to sound, well, reasonable. Then I was told to get in touch with his legal representation, which naturally scared me, but at least I had passed the first audition. The lawyer was lovely on the phone, and just what I expected. Old-school Hollywood, incredibly loyal and protective of Mr. Mathis's career, and rightfully suspicious of me. I explained my book idea as normally as I could, and he asked if Mr. Mathis could approve what I wrote. I explained the journalistic mortal sin of his request, and he said he'd get back to me. Lo and behold, a few days later, an assistant to Mr. Mathis called to set up the meeting at 9:30 a.m. at Mr. Mathis's West Hollywood home. I felt like Prince Summerfall Winter Spring. Until the night before, when I got an email casually mentioning that the lawyer would also be present.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Bah, humbug. I'm Dreaming of a Black Christmas is the first Christmas book from comedian Lewis Black. The uproarious and perpetually apoplectic New York Times bestselling author and Daily Show regular. This is a ferociously funny holiday book. So what does this Jewish guy think about Christmas? Let's listen to Lewis Black narrate.
Did you hurt yourself? He pressed on. Do I need to call somebody? What are you, a Boy Scout? No, I don't need anybody called. You insist on pounding your head like that. You're going to do damage. More damage than you've already done, I mean, he added. Never mind. It's like a pinball machine up there. I'm just whacking it to get it out of the tilt mode. I have an idea, he said. An idea? Are you kidding me? Seriously, ideas are the next thing to go. We are moving rapidly into a world of ideacons. They're like those stupid emoticons, only they pretend to express an idea. Just like you don't have to feel the emotion, pretty soon you won't have to be bothered by thinking either. Ooh, that's good. Save it for the page. The page? Are you talking about paper? You're killing me here. It's all going to be on a screen. It's still a book. What book? The one you should write about Christmas. Are you out of your f***ing mind? A Christmas book based on all the memories I don't have of it? Because, lest you forget, I am a Jew. Lewis, Dickens was a Jew. No, he wasn't. He wanted to be. Not at Christmas time, he didn't. That's your book. That's not a book. It's barely a sentence. The voices in my head were starting to clear their throats again. Glenn Beck wrote a Christmas book. You've got to be kidding me. Called what? Santa's a Tubby Socialist, where Glenn analyzes why a fat man, dressed in red no less, distributes gifts to every single child to teach them the heinous act of sharing? I've got news for you. Santa doesn't bring anything for the Jewish kids because they already worship a socialist god of their own. I'm sure Glenn's even got a chapter about how President Obama believes in Santa more than the country he may or may not have been born in. Not even close, Lewis. But if Glenn Beck can write a book for Christmas, so can you. And as every mom used to say, if Glenn jumped off a roof, would you? Well, if I could get his publishing rights, I would. But I know you can write a better book about Christmas, Lewis. You son of a b- taunting me with Glenn Beck. If I can't write a better book than he does, I should jump off the roof. What makes you think I should write a book about Christmas? You've been Santa twice. They ask you to play Scrooge in a huge production of A Christmas Carol. Yes, you heard that correctly. Me is Scrooge. My career, dear listener, has been a strange one, with twists and turns as weird as anything cooked up by Stephen King or the writers of The Hills. But playing Scrooge, that was truly an odd one. As far as I know, no one I have known in my 40 years in the professional theater ever even considered the possibility of my playing Dickens' most famous Christmas hater. Or, if somebody had thought of the idea, he'd mentioned it to someone else, and the other person had died laughing. If the casting wasn't strange enough, the play's producers were offering me a small fortune to play the role in huge theaters around the country. The reason I mention that they were willing to pay me a bunch of money that felt to me like the kind of money you get in pro sports is that at the time, the economy was tanking. Badly. A Christmas Carol, starring Lewis Black as Scrooge. It sounds like the producers were Bialystock and Bloom from The Producers. Theoretically, it makes a bit of sense. I mean, who better to play Scrooge than a bitter, angry Jew? As ludicrous as the whole idea was, it didn't stop me from picking up the script and looking at it. And who knew what might follow if it worked? Lewis Black as King Lear?
Great Scott! In American on Purpose, Craig Ferguson delivers a moving and achingly funny memoir of living the American dream as he journeys from the mean streets of Glasgow to the promised land of Hollywood. Along the way, he stumbles through several attempts to make his mark as a punk rock musician, a construction worker, a bouncer, and tragically, a modern dancer. To numb the pain of failure, Ferguson found comfort in drugs and alcohol. But his story has a happy ending. In 1993, the washed-up Ferguson washed up in the United States. finally sober, he landed a breakthrough part on the sitcom The Drew Carey Show, a success that eventually led to his role as the host of CBS' The Late Late Show. By far, Ferguson's greatest triumph was his decision to become a U.S. citizen, a milestone he achieved early in 2008, just before his command performance for the president at the White House Correspondents' Association dinner. In American on Purpose, Craig talks a red, white, and blue streak about everything our founding fathers feared. Let's listen.
I understand why Ellen and Steve said no, since this is, without doubt, one of the most intimidating and difficult jobs available to a comedian. And there were other reasons why I, too, should have politely declined. First of all, there was the event's recent history. 2 years before, Stephen Colbert had performed there and, depending on who you talk to, had either died the worst death ever seen by a comic in the history of comedy and death, or had delivered the most fearless piece of political satire this country has ever seen. The year after, in an attempt to avoid any repetition of the controversy, the WHCA had hired the antediluvian Canadian impressionist Rich Little, who most recently achieved fame in the 1970s with his Richard Nixon impersonation, to be the after-dinner speaker. Little had definitely bombed, no debate needed, in a buttock-clenchingly awkward manner. His material was too archaic and meek for the bloodthirsty crowd. I also should have said no because it's the granddaddy of all corporate events, a large dinner in a hotel ballroom where everyone who is there secretly hates and wishes misfortune on everyone else. This is not an atmosphere in which comedy usually flourishes, although having lived in Hollywood for 15 years, I'm used to it. I should have said no because the sound system in the hotel was so awful it was impossible for anyone in the first two rows of tables to understand what was being said, Scottish accent or not. But I didn't say no. I didn't say no because between safety and adventure, I choose adventure. Plus, I thought it would be great crack getting to meet all those muckety mucks and, truthfully, as a new American, I felt it would be somehow unpatriotic to refuse a chance to make a fool of myself in front of the president, who, after all, had no problem doing exactly that in front of the entire world. It certainly was an impressive and eclectic guest list, with Salman Rushdie, Condoleezza Rice and Christiane Amanpour sharing warm chicken cutlets with Pamela Anderson and the Jonas Brothers as they sat around big circular tables. It was such an unlikely collection of people that it actually felt like a dream. So much so that more than once I checked to see if I was wearing pants, something I often do, just in case. With a past like mine, it's never a bad idea. Before the meal, there had been a little reception backstage for the people who would be seated at the dais and their partners, although the only spouses at the head table would be the comfortably arsed Mrs. Bush and Mrs. Cheney, wife to Dirty Dick. It was a chance for everyone to meet and have a chat before we would go out on stage and sit in a line like that Last Supper painting. Ann Compton, the WHCA committee chairman, took charge and whisked Megan and me around the room, introducing us to the other honoured guests. We met the diminutive and sassy White House press secretary, Dana Perino, who revealed to me that she was married to a Scotsman, and I said, well, that would explain why she was crazy. She laughed. I think she thought I was kidding. We met Richard Wolff, the clear-thinking MSNBC political commentator and henchman of the mighty Oberman, who, in a brief conversation, assured me that Barack Obama would be the next president of the United States. This still amazes me because, at that point, Obama didn't even have the Democratic nomination. We met Jose Andres, the celebrity chef, who seemed to me as if he had been hanging around the open bar too long and was banging on in a thick Spanish accent about the wonderful world of tapas. We met a few more broadcasters and White House types whose names now escape me, and then all of a sudden we were standing in front of Mr. and Mrs. Cheney and being introduced. I felt a little awkward. I'm always a bit shy around evil people, so Megan took the lead. She has a knack for dealing with difficult men and is very knowledgeable about fine art, having worked for a time as an art dealer in New York. She and Mrs. C. struck up a conversation about Picasso. The Cheneys were the proud owners of a few of his sketches. "Where do you hang them?" asked Megan. "Oh, we don't," replied Mrs. C. "They're nudes, and we have grandchildren. We don't want them to see them when they come over." "But they're Picassos," protested Megan. "But they're nudes," smiled Mrs. Cheney dangerously. I put a hand on Megan's elbow. I didn't want trouble. You don't want to be in the Cheney list. Dick himself was surprisingly affable and had a croaky, easy laugh, but I did get the very strong impression that I was in the presence of a Bond villain. All he needed was a practice stroke, although not in front of the grandchildren, of course. We made small talk for a while before the Cheneys moved on to the next Gladhanders.
Readers, I have a great new segment for you. Whenever I travel, I take my trusty microphone along, and I stand on a very famous street corner in each and every city I visit. On that corner, I ask readers like you their name, their occupation, and what they're reading. So let's listen to the first bunch I've collected in Washington, D.C. I was actually in DuPont Circle, which is a great corner to catch people like you. Hi, what are you reading?
My name is Paula. I'm a former college professor, and I'm currently a Pilates instructor, and I'm reading The Lacuna by Barbara Kingsolver.
Hi, my name is Chelo, and I am reading Dime Quién Soy por Julia Navarro, and I am a speech language pathologist.
Thank you.
My name is John. I'm a biomedical researcher, and I'm reading Apprentice to Genius.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Susan Hassler writes what she knows, and when you read Intelligence, her debut novel, you need to be afraid. Susan earned a bachelor's in Russian language and literature from the University of Virginia, then a master's degree in Slavic languages and literature from the University of California at Berkeley. Next, she went to work for the Central Intelligence Agency. That was in 1983. She was there for the next 21 years. Susan's jobs at the CIA included foreign documents officer, analyst, speechwriter, editor of their monthly publication, and finally, counterterrorism analyst. She worked in the Counterterrorism Center from 2000 to 2004 when she resigned from the agency. Intelligence is a superb first novel. It reads more like a thinly disguised autobiography. I spoke with Susan at the recent Miami International Book Fair. Hey, welcome, Susan. So nice to have you here today.
Thank you very much.
Well, I loved your book. I've worked in Washington, and I have to tell you, it's entertaining and scary all at the same moment.
Well, thank you.
So the first question is, and the most obvious one is, how true is all of this?
Well, people who used to work at the CIA who get back to me say, wow, you really, this really reminds us of being back there again. It's a lot of it was taken from things that actually happened, and of course the characters are fictitious, but some things I took directly from things that happened. So it's very much a picture of what it's like to be an analyst in the CIA.
Obviously, the terrorist attack in the book is fictitious, but do you think that the general view of the CIA in the book is kind of accurate or very accurate?
I think is very accurate. I've gotten lots of letters from people who used to work at the CIA saying they love the book. So I'm really happy because it was written for my former colleagues. I really admired the people who worked in the Counterterrorist Center, and I hope it comes through in the book that they were really hardworking people who tried their best with a lot of obstacles. And I know in the book there's a pretty negative view of the management of the CIA, but I did run into some wonderful managers. Perhaps not at that period, but
yeah.
I don't want it to be an entirely negative view of the management either.
So are we as citizens, should we be scared?
Well, in terms of being scared of terrorism, it's like being struck by lightning. There will be more terrorism. It's silly to go around living your life like you're afraid of it. It's just such a low probability scenario for the average person. Obviously, when you're flying, you think about it, but you can't really let it affect your life. But yes, I don't think we're going to go back to a time when we thought of terrorism as something that happens in Europe or in the Middle East or somewhere any place but here. We live in an open society, and you can't, unless you want to shut it down and live, you know, under fascist terms, we're going to have terrorism as much as people try to stop it.
Did someone in the CIA read this book before it was published? Was it approved? I mean, how did that work?
We have a publications review board. When you go to the CIA to work, you sign an agreement saying that anything you write that's related to the CIA or to the subject matter that you studied when you were at the CIA, you have to get publications approved. So I went through the publications review board, and they didn't change anything. It's a work of fiction. I was careful to... I made up an insider language to use there because some of the terms for some of the things I use would have been classified. So I just decided, since the CIA insider language changes all the time, and since you can't be entirely correct with it, I just made up my own language, which is why I came up with alchemist and sharpers and tail fires for the hot pieces of intelligence.
So is Maddie a self-portrait?
Well, let's see. I'm not a tiny little ballerina. I'm not divorced. I didn't spend 15 years in the Counterterrorist Center. I don't have a rabbit. It was funny. I have an acquaintance who bought the book and read it, and the next day came up to me and said, "Do you still have the rabbit?" And it took me back a minute, and then I realized he was talking about Abu Bunny, Maddie's rabbit. And no, Maddie is not a self-portrait. There's a little bit of me probably in all the characters, as it is with any writer. I didn't spend 15 years. The main thing is I didn't spend 15 years in terrorism. I was only there a year before 9/11. But there were a lot of people, women especially. A lot of the early Al-Qaeda analysts were women. And so there were plenty of people to draw from for Maddie's character.
You resigned from the CIA in 2004. Was that in any way related to the invasion of Iraq and your personal feelings or what made you resign?
There were a lot of things behind that. I was, the invasion of Iraq just had me completely, I've never felt like that. I wasn't watching TV all the time, so I wasn't getting what everyone else was getting in terms of the build-up to war. I would be at my desk working all day and come home and go, what in the world are they talking about? Why are we invading Iraq? I was physically not doing very well because I did, one thing I do have in common with Maddie, I had back problems, I had stomach problems, I had every tension-related problem in the book. I had just about had it. I was tired. I had lost my parents a few years earlier, and they were in their mid-60s, so I thought, you know, if I'm here another 10 years, I'm not going to have much time after retirement. And my husband was coming up for retirement, so we decided when he retired, I would leave too. So it was a combination of all those things, but I was certainly, at that point, I felt like it didn't matter what I wrote. It absolutely didn't matter what I wrote because we were going to do what we were going to do. And if all of your work, and you're there, you know, 12 hours a day a lot of the time or more, if it doesn't matter, why stay?
So is there a message that you want people to take away with from the book?
I think the main message to take away is not to get caught up in what we were caught up with at the time of the war fury building up towards Iraq. It wasn't just Republicans. It wasn't just the administration. Everyone was voting for that war. And granted, they were lied to, but they could have found out the truth. I mean, it wasn't... there were plenty of people in Washington who knew that this was way overblown, who knew that certainly Iraq was not about to hit us with a nuclear weapon, that there was no mushroom cloud waiting out there. And people, you know, the other thing is that psychologically I can understand why the country wanted to strike back. You know, they had knocked down the World Trade Center. It was a horrible psychological thing for the country, and we wanted to hit something hard. We wanted shock and awe was psychologically what we wanted to do. We wanted to go bomb the crap out of something. And the problem is, with terrorists, there's not much to bomb the crap out of. Yeah. They move around.
Who are you waiting for?
We're thinking of terrorism in terms of a war. It's really not any sort of regular war where you have these fixed targets that you can hit. The best way to go at them is quietly through espionage, through targeted strikes. But the country wanted something like the bombing of Baghdad. It wanted to strike back at somebody. And I think that's part of why we went to war. And I think we have to remember that the most important thing to remember in ending terrorism is to think not about the victims of the last attack, because then you're going to go and do something that you'll regret later. Think about the victims of the next attack. How do we prevent that attack from happening? And those are two different things.
Yes. Well, I have to say that it's an amazing book, Intelligence by Susan Hassler. Everyone should read it. It's a great, fun, exciting, scary read. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you.
Let's end our audiobook gift overview with one that's sure to evoke nostalgia among many of our reader listeners. For years, Dick Cavett played host to the nation's most famous personalities on his late-night talk show. In this humorous and evocative book, we get to hear Cavett's best tales as he recounts... In this humorous and evocative book, we get to hear Cavett's best tales as he recounts great moments with the legendary entertainers who crossed his path. He offers his own commentary on contemporary American culture and politics. Pull up a chair and listen to Cavett's stories about one-upping Betty Davis, testifying on behalf of John Lennon, confronting Richard Nixon, scheming with John Updike, befriending William F. Buckley, and palling around with Groucho Marx. Sprinkled in are tales of his childhood in Nebraska in the 1940s and 50s, where he honed his sense of comic timing and his love of magic. Cavett is also a wry cultural observer, looking at America today and pointing out the foibles that we so often fail to notice about ourselves. And don't even get him started on politicians. A generation of Americans ended their evenings in Dick Cavett's company. Talk show is a way to welcome him back.
When Groucho guest hosted the Tonight Show way back, the first laugh I got for him was an aside I wrote. But enough of this bridled hilarity. In Groucho's voice, it got a laugh well out of proportion to its merits. I found it relatively easy to write for others. It's not always easy to identify your own voice. That comes with time. Before I ever sat down and tried to host a talk show, I had a call from Jack Parr. He had given me my first job as a comedy writer when I was still in my early 20s. Jack was a hero of mine. More of an obsession, really, and I rarely missed The Tonight Show when Jack was its host. When I got the job writing for Jack, I thought that if there is a heaven, it will be an anticlimax to this. The fact that I was handsomely paid, think of it, $360 a week, and every week, barely occurred to me. I was there, on the inside of The Tonight Show. I watched the show as it was taped every night, and then watched it again at home. I think Jack sensed my obsession. He called me aside one night after the show and said, "Kid, you shouldn't hang around here through the show. It'll ruin your life. Go home." After that, I watched the show from a part of the studio where Jack couldn't see me. Years passed, and the chance for me to host a talk show came along. This had never, ever been my ambition. My highest goal in this regard was to come, maybe someday, into a studio and be a guest on a talk show. Hosting was not even a dream. That was for the giants of my time, Steve Allen, Jack, Johnny. When the non-dream came true, and I was about to do my own show, a call came from Jack. It bore the single best piece of advice I or anyone doing a show could get. "Kid, I've only got one piece of advice of what you might call counseling for you. Don't do interviews." What could Jack mean? To do the whole show myself? Show movies, read to the viewers? That exciting, nervous, famous voice continued. I mean, don't just do interviews, pal. You know, interview. It smacks of Q&A and David Frost and his clipboard and what's your favorite color and crap like most embarrassing moments. Don't do any of that. Make it a conversation. In a way, it's the whole secret. Conversation is when people simply talk and don't take a test on the air with Q&A. It's when something said spontaneously prompts a thought and a reply in someone else. And when several people's talk moves around a subject and changes directions, produces spontaneous and entertaining comments and unexpected insights, takes surprising turns, that's conversation. And how right Jack was. He could do a whole good show without that tired old, "Let me ask you this." Feel free to pass this on to anyone about to do a talk show. A conversation doesn't have to be scintillating in order to be memorable. I once met a president of the United States, and his second sentence to me was about knees. Back when I was still persona grata at the Nixon White House, a period of time that proved to be of short duration, I met Richard Nixon in reception line at the White House, and it so happened that on a recent trip to England, Nixon had been told that the greatest Hamlet yet was Nicol Williamson, currently playing the Dane on the London stage. But duty called in Washington, and Nixon had to return without seeing the play, so he invited Williamson for an evening of Shakespeare at the White House, and somehow I was invited. Tuxedoed, I moved along the reception line until I was nose to nose with the president. "Nixon, who's doing your show tonight?" "Joe Namath." Nixon, with a look of solemn concern. "How are his knees?" Part of the psychological makeup of your Belinda's most famous native son was his obsession with masculinity. "So-and-so was a real man," he would say, and real men knew football. It would not be long before I stopped receiving invitations to the White House. My lack of popularity with the great unindicted co-conspirator came when I testified for John Lennon, after he and Yoko Ono had been twice on my ABC show, to support the case that John should not be deported by the Nixon administration. On one of the Nixon tapes, the president's henchman and lickspittle, H.R. Haldeman, can be heard educating his boss, who was minimally knowledgeable of popular culture, about Lennon's vast popularity with the words, "This guy could sway an election."
It's been such fun to have you join me this week. I hope you've had a little break from the frenzy of the holiday season and have also picked up some ideas to make your holiday shopping easier. And if you're listening in the car, be careful not to crack up too much at these really funny audiobooks. By the way, I'd love to hear from you with your comments or requests. You can write to me at elaine@bookreportradio.com. And don't forget to tell your friends that they should listen to this show, so spread the word for me. Have a wonderful week. I'm Elaine Charles, ending this chapter of The Book Report.